pansy liberal show. It's Bart Cop Radio.
Here's another Michael Moore tidbit. Those of you who have seen the film know that in the middle of the film they give a phone number. A congressman, apparently his name is Porter Goss of Florida, the congressman in the film says, I've got an 800 number, call me if you got a complaint about whatever the, I don't know, the election, whatever the problem is. And then Moore comes on and explains that the congressman either lied or misspoke. He does not have an 800 number, so you can't call him. So Mike gives out his real number. I believe it starts with the 202. So we got a headline. Fahrenheit prompts calls to Congressman's office. Michael Moore's 9/11 has the phones ringing in the Capitol Hill office of Representative Porter Goss, Republican Nazi, Florida, chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. In the film, which opened nationwide 2 weeks ago, Goss discusses the Patriot Act. He says Americans with concerns about the intelligence network can call a toll-free number. Moore tells viewers that there is no such number and instead displays the phone number to Goss's office. We're getting hundreds of calls, spokeswoman Julie whatever said. She said Goss didn't mean to imply that a toll-free number exists. Well, no, he didn't imply a goddamn thing. It's what he said. We all heard him. The man's image shows up on the screen and he says, I got a toll-free number. Call me. Don't tell us what he meant to imply. We saw what he said. You know, I understand spin, but when you just flat lie, he didn't mean to imply that. No, he didn't mean to say that. If you want forgiveness, confess. Okay, speaking of Michael Moore, I have found the article, the only article I've found so far that uses any kind of logic to attack Michael Moore's film is written by Ellen Goodman, a self-proclaimed Clinton liberal Democrat. She's all for Michael Moore, but she says he's singing to the choir and she can't quite hit the notes because she thinks Michael is lying to her. Now, check some of this language out. Oh, this makes me sick. It tells me I have not done my job. It tells me there is so much work to do. Well, let's give it a little prelim. Maybe it was because the man on my left was doing a play-by-play when any member of Bush's team came on the screen. Maybe it was because the movie theater was within pitching range of Fenway Park. But halfway through 9/11, I realized this wasn't the audience. It was a fan club. They weren't watching the movie. They were rooting for it. So I was moving to sold-out theater. Yak, yak, yak. The Fahrenheit 9/11 preaches to the choir, you could find me in the alto section. More to that point, or more with two O's to the point. Lady, don't do the comedy. What the hell's wrong with you? Tell the damn story and quit trying to be a cute comic. I agreed with the filmmaker that Bush didn't exactly win the 2000 election, and that we were misled into Iraq, and that the White House has used the terrorism alerts as a political toy. So, add my review to the marquee, I laughed, I cried. But, now here we go. Here we go. Rubber about to meet the road. But at some point, I also began to feel a touch out of harmony. Not even this alto believes that the Iraq War was brought to us courtesy of the Bush-Saudi oil money connection. Not even the rosiest pair of my retro spectacles sees pre-war Iraq as a happy valley where little children flew kites. Now, what in the world... Why does this woman want to deny Michael Moore's right to make a point? I can't speak for Michael Moore, but I'll tell you what I got out of that. What he was telling us is what Iraq was not a total torture chamber, that it was possible to exist. You know, something that's gone unsaid, it's my guess, if you didn't try to overthrow Saddam, you weren't tortured. It's just my guess that they just were too busy to send men out, you know, 100 miles from Baghdad, to go look for some farmer or whatever, some guy sitting there and say, hey, we're going to take you into town and torture you. It's like, well, no, I just have to think they're too busy to just randomly torture people for no reason. It would be my guess that if they got word that you were talking bad about Saddam, that you're saying someone needs to shoot that bastard, or we need to take some action, or I wish we had a different government, or yak, 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 which I agree with all that. But if they catch you plotting against them, they're going to send agents to your house. That's what happens in America. Doesn't that happen in every country? If you plot to overthrow Guatemala, doesn't the Guatemalan government send goons to your house and pull you in and, you know, slap you around, see what you're about? I would imagine that's true everywhere. The idea that this lady is saying Children with kites cannot have a good time in pre-war Iraq. I don't understand that kind of thinking. Are they saying everybody in Iraq was totally depressed and demoralized all the time? I don't believe that. You can find people having a laugh in prison. No matter how bad your conditions are, sometimes you're going to blow off some steam, you're going to have some whatever ghetto humor, gallows humor, whatever that's called. But they're saying that Michael Moore lied when he showed the kids flying the kite and the girl getting married and said, hell, we've bombed a few weddings. During the war, the weddings went on, and I suppose the little kids are flying kites during the war. Would it be a lie to show the kids flying a kite during the war? They obviously had weddings during the war because we keep bombing those. I don't understand this. Ellen Goodman, she wants to say that what Michael Moore showed was not there. I assume she's saying that he hired little children who were depressed and offered them dinars and built them kites and said, hey, would you stand in front of my camera, and when I count to three, would you pretend you're happy, and you pretend you're happy about having a kite, and you pretend you're happy about flying your kite? Would you do that for me so I can fool the Americans? I do not think that's what happened. I think Michael Moore went to Iraq, and he said, get me some pictures that aren't all death and doom and gloom, and my hands cut off, and they murdered my family and raped my mother and my sisters. Can you get me some film of the positive side of Iraq? But this Ellen Goodman saying that isn't possible. Here's another one. There were far too many cheap shots among the direct hits. Conspiracy theories, tidbits of propaganda in the documentary. Going for the jugular, he sometimes went over the top. Could you give us some examples? What is it going to take for someone to offer an example? This lady can't believe the war was brought to us by the Bush-Saudi oil money connection. To me, that's saying that evil men would not fabricate a reason to go to war to make themselves even more in control of the planet they control. She's saying that absolute power does not corrupt. Is there anyone that will take her side in that argument? I can't think of one. To have the strongest military in the world and to have both houses of Congress and the Supreme Court in your pocket, you can go crazy, and that's what Bush has done. He's not going to be impeached. He's not going to be called before hearings. I mean, he'll volunteer to go before a hearing not under oath with his mouthpiece with him, with his security banky going there with him, but George Bush was not, he knew he was not going to be investigated. If your dad's the police chief, you can commit any crime you want. You can rob the bank, you can rape the high school queen, you can shoot your enemies, you can run the red light, you can drive drunk. If your dad is the sheriff in the small town, if you control the law enforcement in your area, or in Bush's case, the world, you can do anything you want. And so this lady, Ellen Goodman, can't figure out why Bush might have misled us into this war. That's really dangerous talk, and of course, it's our side giving Bush the break. I'll bet behind closed doors, the Republicans are saying, this idiot's going crazy. What are we going to do to stop him? But no, the Democrats, as always, they're jumping out there to give supply and ammo to the enemy. Boy, I hate being a Democrat sometimes.
There are patriots fighting the illegal Bush regime that you've never heard of.
Check out
ProudLiberals.com for debate, humor, and news. That's ProudLiberals.com.
Click on
FunnyFarmOnline.org. If you want to stay sane while Bush is president, visit the Funny Farm at FunnyFarmOnline.org.
Visit
JPSalesTraining.com. When we take our country back, you'll need training programs for your new employees. Go to JPSalesTraining.com now for progressive, interactive, and great training resources.
Check out
AmazingPlanet.com. Banned by eBay for hitting too close to the truth. Get your t-shirts from AmazingPlanet.com.
Click on
DoYouKnow.org for the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth about that bad boy, George W. Bush. DoYouKnow.org. And visit BartCop.com for the funniest anti-Bush invective on the net. Somebody has to fight back. We're doing it. See BartCop.com for more information. That's BartCop.com.
Do it now.
Did Ronald Reagan's enduring love for Jane Wyman nearly ruin his romance with Nancy? Well, Mark Steinus has more intimate details from the pages of Vanity Fair.
Wait, now I don't understand. This is the American media, and they're about to give you a less than flattering portrait of Reagan and Nancy. Now, maybe they messed up. Maybe they don't understand this was for American consumption, but how could anybody say anything unflattering about St. Reagan? I just don't understand it. This is on a major network saying something less than flattering about St. Reagan?
Recalling her first day with Ronald Reagan, Nancy Davis said, quote, I saw it clearly that very first night. He was everything I wanted.
Don't mean to beat up on Nancy Reagan, but don't you think it was an extreme disservice she did? And I'm not saying everybody has to be a flaming feminist, you know, but Nancy Reagan's quote was, "My life didn't begin until I met Ronnie." What kind of horrible, horrible example is that to send to a impressionable 6 or 10, whatever-year-old little girl, that your life is worth nothing until you meet the man that can take care of you? Your life is such crap that you don't exist until you meet a man. And, oh, they're about to tell you what kind of man she met, too. But, you know, it's the opposite of Hillary. Hillary is like her own woman. If she lost Bill, she could still be somebody. You know, Nancy existed only to be there for Ronnie, and that borders on sick. I just don't think that's a healthy relationship at all. You know, two people are supposed to complement each other. You're not supposed to get your identity from running into the other person. That's not how it works. I think Nancy had a little sickness in her, and you're about to hear what kind of sickness her husband had.
But Reagan and Wyman had been divorced for just over a year.
Now remember, Jane Wyman was Mr. Spock's mother on the original Star Trek. If Jane Wyman was Spock's mom, that would make Reagan Spock's daddy, at least stepdad.
And the new book claims he was still so taken by his ex-wife that any relationship with Nancy nearly derailed before it began.
So Reagan was really depressed after his wife dumped him and had trouble getting over it. Sounds like it might make a fascinating movie or a plot for some soap opera, but gee, I don't know. Does it make a presidential love story? How happy they were for eternity with his second wife and her second husband.
The book reports that after the divorce, he continued to dine with Wyman, and she is said to have played with his hopes of reconciliation.
Well, it sounds like the author is saying that Wyman used puppy-struck Reagan to toy with and mess him around, probably used him, probably got some dinners out of the deal. Sounds like Reagan was in poor condition at the time.
He moved into the old apartment they once shared as newlyweds and is described as obsessed and lonely.
Well, that sounds like an extremely sad and probably mentally deficient place to be. Apparently what they're saying is Reagan and Spock's mother used to live in this place, and then they both moved out, someone else moved in, and then later Ronnie saw that the apartment was for rent again, so he moved back in. Now, why did he do that? So he could stare at the walls and drink and think about the love he'd lost and what a worthless piece of crap he was, that he was such shit that she couldn't live with him, and, oh, having her the drink, and, oh, that's where she used to sit, and, oh, that's where she used to cook dinner, and, oh, that's where she used to stand, and, oh, that was the door she came through every night, oh, and they have another drink, and, oh, it's so sad, and my life's lost, oh. And Nancy was quite attracted to this guy.
In the book, author Bob Colicello writes that Reagan coped with his loneliness by drinking too much, spending too much, and dating a succession of actresses and models.
Aha, now we're getting to it. So apparently here was Reagan, alley-catting around Hollywood, sniffing at the back door of anything in a skirt. He apparently was the Colin Farrell of his day. Drinking, whoring, probably smoking pot, going to parties, probably having sex parties. He's young, famous, handsome, got some money. He's in Hollywood going through movie stars and fashion models like he's Leo DiCaprio or Fred Durst, just banging one after the next. And here comes Nancy. She wanted to get in on the party. Think about it. Here's Mr. Family Values, depressed, drunk, whoring his way through all of Hollywood. And probably the big common factor is his age. You know, by the time Reagan hit the White House, he was pretty much a dried-up old man. He had no interest in sex. There was no fire in the furnace. He was just an old man interested in getting his hands on as many millions as he could. And there's nothing a whole lot wrong with that. But the point is, Clinton made it to the White House while he still had some passion, while he was still a young man, still had some sexual urges. That's Clinton's big crime. We see Clinton and Reagan both whoring around. But Reagan didn't make it to high office till he was a very old man. That's one of the differences.
He writes that Reagan would, quote, brag to a buddy that he was sleeping with so many different women that he woke up one morning and couldn't remember the name of the gal I was in bed with.
Look at Mr. Republican screwing everything he can get his hands on. He's so drunk he doesn't remember what their name is. Who are you, lady? Who are you, sir? What are you doing in my bed? The drunken lout. In a alcohol fog, screwing anything he could get his hands on. All the time telling himself it was Jane Wyman.
He seemed taken on that first date with Nancy, saying he was enchanted by her laugh. but he was not ready for commitment. And Nancy understood why, explaining, quote, he had been burned in his first marriage, and the pain went deep.
Aw, the pain went deep, all the way to his crotch. Now suddenly he gets a pass. Oh, he was in such pain, he had to screw every starlet he could get his hands on. He had to screw every model he could get his hands on. Oh, the pain. It was so hard to contain. All he could do was have another drink and screw another woman. Oh, the pain, the pain.
Dating off and on, the two would also see other people.
Or, put more honestly, Reagan was screwing every starlet in Hollywood. Why would he want to give that up to live a life with Nancy? He told her, lady, I'm sorry, I ain't ready. I'm busy over here. I got shit to do Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I might could fit you in for an ice cream on Sunday, but I got a date Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I don't have the time, lady. Meanwhile, Nancy's sitting there, oh, I just wish he'd call. I know he's out screwing all those other women, but oh, I just wish he'd call me. Maybe I could turn him around.
But around Christmas of 1951, Nancy pressed the issue. The book has her saying, quote, I finally got up the courage to ask him what was for me a very bold question. Do you want me to wait for you? And he said, yes, I do.
Oh, Christ, what a doormat. Excuse me, but while you're screwing everything that moves, do you want me to leave or do you want me to hang here like a puppy and hope you'll come back? Yes, hang there like a puppy. Maybe I'll come back. Meanwhile, I got more women to screw. Back later. Bye, Nancy.
At this time, both their acting careers were shaky. Reagan's movie contract was running out, and Nancy's was also coming to an end.
More translation. His career was crashing to a halt, and since he couldn't act, the odds of him getting picked up by another studio were slim and none.
In January of 1952, she told her future husband she was thinking of going to New York. At dinner, he responded by saying, I think we ought to get married. She said, I think so too.
Oh, please, they're still using 50s language to couch the truth. She got up the courage to press the issue. No, she discovered she was pregnant, and she went to the alley cat and told him is what happened. Do the math. He just gave you the date where she said we need to get married and then check out their firstborn's date of birth. What we're seeing here is the small town values of Dixon, Illinois, where old Dutch learned about family and love and leadership and doing the right thing. Meanwhile, he's screwing everything with a skirt. Nancy's sitting there like a puppy dog waiting for him to get done. Oh, is that not sick or what?
And just weeks later, that's just what they did.
Well, obviously, they didn't wait too long. She didn't want to be 8 months walking down the aisle. Jesus.
The book also claims on their very first date, Ron urged Nancy to change her name because so many other actresses went by Nancy Davis. She told him she couldn't do that.
On their first date? Gee, what a gentleman. Hi, my name's Ron. What's yours? Nancy? Oh, you ought to change your name. Jesus. Of course, I guess back then the women were supposed to be the doormat and the man was supposed to be the bully. At least she stood up to him on that. She don't mind him screwing everything in Hollywood, the entire southern half of the state. No, she didn't mind Reagan going through that, but oh, change my name? Now I put my foot down.
Burn, Hollywood, burn. I smell a riot going on. First,
don't touch that dial. Though you don't have a dial because you're probably listening to this on the computer.
All the news and views are beneath me.